It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. UW researchers say bees in general are the most important pollinating animals in the world. We explore the lives of these hard workers and specifically bumblebees as they pollinate wildflowers and crops. Call in with questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Holly Petrillo is here, forestry professor at UW Stevens Point. Holly, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you have your students looking for bumblebees at different sites in central Wisconsin. What is the purpose of documenting where bumblebees can be found?
Well, one of the basic reasons why we're doing this is just to get a baseline of information, which bumblebees are in central Wisconsin and where, you know, how many there are, where they're found, what resources they're using. There's not very much information out there. And so kind of the most important thing before we figure out, you know, what to do and what people can do to get involved is to know where we're at with bumblebee populations.
I wonder, why isn't there a baseline of information on how bumblebees are doing in the central part of the state?
Well, it's not just in the central part. It's really, throughout Wisconsin and in many states, there just isn't a lot of information available. I think when people think about bees, we focus a lot on honeybees, and we know a lot of information about honeybees because they do pollinate a lot of our commercial crops. And so there's a lot of monitoring that goes along with honeybee populations, but our native bees, which include bumblebees, there's just not as much information about. And they're not pests. You know, pests get a lot of attention, and they're not pests. They're important, obviously, but our kind of time and efforts usually get funneled to things that are, say, economically important, like honeybees, or things that are causing damage. And so bumblebees and other native bees don't fall into that category. And so historically, they've just been a bit neglected.
And the students are contributing to the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade, which is a DNR effort. Can you tell us about this, the Bumblebee Brigade?
Sure. Yeah, this is a really phenomenal project that the DNR has taken on. And like you said, the students wanted to have a meaningful research project. There's already this statewide program going on. The DNR manages it, but it is a citizen science project where anyone can contribute data if you're interested in monitoring for bumblebees. You know, it's something anyone can participate in. But the objectives of the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade are really, again, what I was saying, developing this baseline of information, maps of where our native bumblebees are found throughout the state, and really focusing in on the resources they're using. So which plants, and that includes herbaceous plants, trees, shrubs, you know, which plants they're using, other kind of habitat. Most of our bumblebees and other native bees are ground nesters. And so trying to figure out where their nesting sites are. And so all of that information will help us preserve them better. So knowing what types of habitats they need, what types of plants they need, can help us figure out what we can do to increase their populations.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about pollinators, specifically bumblebees, with UW Stevens Point forestry professor Holly Petrillo. You can join in with your questions along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. You know, as you get this baseline of information through the Bumblebee Brigade and other projects you have going on, Holly, how does that intersect with climate change and how climate change is affecting these pollinators like bumblebees?
That's a great question. I think part of it has to do when different flowers are in bloom and when bumblebees may be needing resources, especially in the springtime. So that's a crucial time for really any, all of our insect populations and plants, as we say, have earlier bloom times than we often are going to see insects emerging earlier in the spring as well. And so resources may change over time, or the plants that that bumblebees and other bees have access to will likely change over time. And that kind of goes also to the end of, on the other end of the spectrum, when we're talking about fall resources as well. So how long plants are available for nectar and for pollen, and how insects are using those resources. And it's not just those kind of spring and fall changing, but that's where we've been seeing the most dramatic changes in climate in the Great Lakes region anyway.
And certainly the impact on rainfall amounts can have such an impact on the vegetation and what the offerings are for pollinators.
Right, absolutely. And it isn't the same everywhere. Right? Mm-hmm. So some areas are becoming much drier, some becoming much wetter. And so that is changing the dynamics of plants and what's growing in those areas. And then thinking about, again, a lot of our native pollinators are, or native bees in particular, are ground nesters. And so thinking about where their habitat may be available. If areas are becoming more wet, then they may look, you know, have to change and go to drier ground. So they may just completely change where their habitat availability is.
It goes back to that location monitoring. And I understand you operate a small organic farm and have a variety of fruit trees. How do your crops benefit from pollinators?
Well, we need the pollinators so that we get fruit. And so that's one of the amazing things about the relationship between insects and plants is almost all of the food crops that we enjoy, or I would say fruit and nut crops, they need insect pollinators. I mean, unless we want to go around and hand pollinate everything, we need the insects to pollinate our plants to provide all of the fruits that we love. And that, so I think a lot of times when we think about habitat for bees, we may be thinking about herbaceous plants, and those are certainly important, but our flowering trees and shrubs require insect pollinators as well. So thinking about all of the apples, cherries, blueberries, plums, all of our favorite summer fruits require pollination right now in the spring from insects.
How do you feel about, like, bumblebees can be rented or purchased for crop pollination, you know, farmers contracting with beekeepers to truck in bees to ensure their crops are well pollinated? What do you think about that practice?
Sure. So those are managed honeybee colonies. So honeybees are not native, but they are really important for agricultural production. And there is some competition that occurs between honeybees and our native bees for food resources. But to be honest, I think at the scale at which we are now practicing agriculture, we don't have enough habitat for our native bees to do all of that pollination. So, I mean, a lot of it just comes down to the way that we practice agriculture and require, you know, a lot of pollination of one crop all at one time, you know, in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I would love it if we had more crop diversity and didn't need to be, you know, trucking bees all over. But I think at the current state of agriculture, we really need those honeybees. Otherwise, we won't get the level of fruit and nut production that we seek.
UW-Stevens Point Forestry Professor Holly Petrillo helping us to understand the critical work of pollinators and how we can improve their habitats. Call in with questions along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn what it means to provide early season food for pollinators and how to view our green spaces from their perspective. As the climate crisis and habitat loss threaten a variety of pollinators, you can be part of this conversation. Call in with questions, thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Holly Petrillo, a professor of forestry at UW Stevens Point. Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. One of the things we see with modern agribusiness is to remove vegetation and tree lines in between fields, or separating tracts of land from one owner to another. It's just that's being removed all over the place. You see it all over the state. How is that impacting bee populations?
Jeff, thank you. Holly, do you have insights there?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. That does directly impact any kind of pollinator habitat or insect habitat. I think as we slowly increase our agricultural production, any loss of just kind of wild spaces, you may not think wild space next to a large agricultural field, but any native plants that are going to be available will contrast with the fields of just one type of plant and provides important habitat. And especially thinking not just about the plants that are there, but the nesting habitat that's in or on the ground next to those agricultural fields. And so if farmers can leave those buffers, leave those, as natural as you can call that, in between the fields, we already have protections for riparian areas, but if we could treat all of our kind of farm buffers that way, leaving some kind of refuge for any kind of animal, really, but with focusing on pollinators, that really makes a big difference.
Trees,
as we expand agriculture, we just lose habitat.
I was going to say these tree barriers as well, not just marking where land stops and starts, but I would imagine they're also wind breaks and help keep soil in place.
Absolutely, there are so many benefits for having these buffers. Having trees and a mix of trees and shrubs and herbaceous plants in those buffers, the more diversity you can have, the better. And right, just like you're saying, not just having pollinator resources, but soil conservation is really important. And again, just providing that nesting space in addition to the plants there, something to buffer so that you're, and the windbreak as well. I mean, there's endless benefits.
Jeff, thank you so much for the call. We also, Holly, heard from Jim in Cedarburg, emailed with saying Nomome is great, but Jim is saying that it is also important to leave leaf litter undisturbed, and says leaf litter is critical for bird fodder. What can you tell us there?
Sure. Yeah, I think No Mow May is a great way to to get people interested. It's very visual. It's something that's easy. I mean, maybe one of the easiest things you can do is to not do something, right? Don't mow in May. It is hopefully a hook to get people interested in going further, if that makes sense. Absolutely. The leaf litter serves as nesting habitat for a lot of our native bees. And I mean, we think about insects as beneficial, for example, for pollination, but yeah, a lot of birds are insectivores, and they require insects for their food resources. And so anyone that's really interested in bees, birds should also be interested in bees and other insects and providing habitat, because a lot of our birds depend on insects, and they're creating nests right now and feeding their young, and they need insects for their food sources.
So you know, the timing here, not mowing a lawn for a relatively short period of time can result in more mowing later, which can kill or displace insects and animals, as you've been talking about. But are there any better alternatives to putting off mowing yards?
Well, I think that there's, I mean, not mowing in the springtime when, especially if we're focusing back on bumblebees, they're emerging, they're foraging, they need, all insects really need that energy right away in mm-hmm. the spring when they are laying eggs and starting to feed young. But thinking about, again, kind of moving forward, having habitat, so thinking about our lawns, I mean, there's millions and millions of acres in the U.S., for example, of just lawn. And if we converted even just a fraction of that to more native habitat, then we would, you know, make a significant impact on conservation of insect habitat, pollinator habitat. And so it can morph into something that's just passive, not mowing, but still having that lawn structure. There's a really great program being piloted in the city of Stevens Point here in central Wisconsin, where they're encouraging and supporting families to totally change their lawn from grass, which is not utilized by insects, to more native habitats. And so, again, going that extra step and saying, okay, first, maybe I just won't mow and be comfortable with that. But yeah, that becomes kind of unruly, right? And a lot of people, I get a lot of complaints like, oh, well, then June, it's so hard to mow. So why don't we just not mow then also? And
keep
but
it going.
Instead of still having that grass, instead of it looking crazy, because a lot of people don't like crazy looking, right? Like unkept areas. Uh-huh. Why don't we transform those spaces to provide habitat and have, you know, beautiful flowers at the same time? And so we can serve a lot of different purposes that way.
We have UW Stevens Point Forestry Professor Holly Petrillo. You can join in on Pollinators 800-642-1234. Holly, to that point, there are these bee lawns incorporating Dutch white clover, creeping thyme. You know, these plants have the flowers that bees appreciate. How difficult is establishing and maintaining a bee lawn?
I think the challenge is the establishment and just getting rid of the sod and you know, I think establishment, once you have that sod layer removed, I mean, you kind of have just an open space and the establishment is easier after mm-hmm. that. So I think that initial removal of the sod, and there's lots of amazing, you know, landscape professionals and extension folks that can help in terms of the how and also on that physical doing. But once those plants are planted, especially if you're focusing on perennials, they will perpetuate themselves. And so it really would just be every year kind of trying to figure out, maybe start small. You know, I mean, when you're thinking about a lawn, or I mean, I say the same thing when I talk to people about farming, start small. Start with an area that you can handle and then just do a little bit more every year.
Grow from there. Yes.
Yeah. But really, then thinking, yeah, sorry.
That's okay. Really quickly here, Linda in Appleton wants to know your opinion on rain gardens. Does this help pollinators? Should cities incentivize rain gardens? What is the impact?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, any wild or, you know, think about semi-wild spaces, in an urban area provides really critical habitat. So whether you call it, I mean, rain gardens are really great because they do provide habitat for pollinators. They also try to deal with some of the, you know, runoff and water issues that urban areas may have. So again, serving multiple purposes. Anything that we can do in our landscape that's concrete and lawn to provide refuge for insects in those areas actually does make a huge difference. Mm. And so the more people that participate, the more habitat is going to be available.
Holly, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Holly Petrillo is a forestry professor at UW-Stevens Point. Find a link to the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The New York Times investigates robocalls that made millions of dollars with ties to Wisconsin. And here's how it goes with this audio published by The New York Times.
Carla? Finally, it's good to hear a kind voice. That last call was tougher on me than my mother-in-law's meatloaf. I'm only kidding.
Dad joke aside, the voice then gives a phony pitch to help police.
This is Frank Wallace calling for the American Police Officers Alliance. Very quickly, we're mailing out the envelopes to help fight for our officers who protect our nation's citizens, just like yourself. Once you receive your card in the mail, you can send back whatever you think is fair this time. That's all.
We discuss the tactics, the robotics, and let's hear from you. Call in with questions or thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. David Farenthold is an investigative reporter in the New York Times' Washington, D.C. Bureau. David, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard the robocall there. What can you tell us about the voice and its message?
I mean, this is one thing that really surprised me reporting that story. If you got that phone call, you would think, or I would think, that I was talking to a person. And in fact, you're talking to a really sophisticated computer program, and they have... They get a voice actor to record both that sort of initial spiel that you heard, a whole bunch of names. So if you have a common name, it can say your name at the beginning, but also things like responses. So if you say, well, is this a charity or are you a robot? There's a little, you know, there's somebody behind the computer who can hit a button that plays a segment of a snippet of dialogue that answers that question. So you can have a whole conversation with this guy and never realize you're talking to a computer. The other thing that's really amazing and kind of insidious about these things is that little joke at the beginning. They're so tough on me. It's tougher than me, on me than my mother-in-law's meatloaf. There's other ones where the guy will say, you know, you're harder to catch than a rabbit on roller skates. Well, basically, they want to make you feel bad for this person. This person, it sounds like, that's calling you has a job where they have to call people who are rude to them or they don't pick up the phone a lot of the time. So now you start off the call feeling like, oh, sorry, I'm so sorry for this guy. And now you're feeling sorry for a computer. It's an amazing technology.
It is an amazing technology, and I could subtly hear a change in intonation from the word Carla to the rest of the audio, and I'm wondering if that was some type of computer programming as well as they put the name of the person into this type of software.
I think that's right. I think that's the guy clicking the button for Carla and then quickly clicking the button for, you know, they call it like a spiel, start the spiel.
Ah, okay. So let's get the backstory here. Since 2014, you say the groups behind these calls have collectively raised nearly $90 million from small dollar donations. Who is donating to these groups?
These groups, so there's two groups that say they're helping the police, including the one we just heard from, but there's also two that say they're helping veterans and one that say they're helping firefighters. And the people, they're donors. When you hear donor, you might think of some really rich person giving a lot of money. But donors are very small dollar donors. They give things like $25 donations, $200 donations. They give just thousands and thousands and thousands of small dollar donations. Imagine how many donations you'd have to get $90 million, $35 at a time. So it affects and it wins over and it convinces a whole lot of people.
So four of the five fundraising nonprofits are active. What do the leaders behind these groups say about this work?
Well, so these groups, just to take one step back, these groups are they're political nonprofits. They're not a charity in a legal sense. They're supposed to be taking this money in and using it for politics, to help candidates, help run ads for candidates, to do things that are going to get people elected. And when said, only about 1% of the $90 million they raised has gone to anything like that, has gone to help candidates or gone to influence races. The rest of it mostly gets used on more fundraising, keeping the scheme going, and sort of getting siphoned off to these three political consultants from Wisconsin who are behind, so the hidden force behind all these groups. And what the groups say is, well, look, we just believe in influencing politics indirectly. We want to help a politician. We don't want to give them money or run an ad with their name in it or even tell people we support them. We're just going to run some very subtle ads and very subtle messaging that will make you, you know, raise issues in your mind that might make you a voter for that person down the road. And to that end, they say that even that call that you heard, to them, that is political messaging. A guy calls you on the phone and asks you for money and says the police need your help. They say that's politics. That's not a distraction from the work they're supposed to be doing. They're doing a public good right then.
Can you talk further about this hidden force, as you call it, behind these calls and the connection to Wisconsin as you talk to all of Wisconsin? Is there a reason the consultants are here?
I don't know that there's any advantage to being in Wisconsin. These are just three guys who got their start in politics in Wisconsin. So the most prominent of them is a guy named John Connors, who he's from sort of timber country in northern Wisconsin. He went to Marquette. He got involved in the Scott Walker political machine while he was at Marquette. He graduated from Marquette in 2008. And then he went on to have several sort of minor roles in the political machine that surrounded Scott Walker in those days. And so then he started his own political firm. He hired a couple of other guys, Kyle Mikely, who's from Madison, and Simon Lewis, who's from West Bend. And they all worked together at this political consulting firm around 2011, 2012. And then they sort of Mikely and Lewis, the two guys he hired, went off and started their own companies, but they seem to have kept this sort of close alliance. And they, according to the people who really know these groups well, those three are the ones who helped set up these nonprofits, basically creating clients for themselves. They set up nonprofits, and then they build the nonprofits they helped create in a relationship that was really hard to see from the outside.
And it sounds like it's really lucrative if only 1% of the funds are actually going to political causes and candidates.
Yes, it is a really such a different operation than a real political campaign. So a real political campaign fundraises for a purpose. They want to get a bunch of money they can use to help themselves get elected. This is an operation that mostly fundraises to keep fundraising and then takes a little sliver off the top for these insiders. There's a lot more freedom. You have a lot more freedom to spend your money if you don't need money left over to actually spend on politics.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about Wisconsin-linked robocalls with David Farenthold, investigative reporter for The New York Times, who worked on this piece. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. David, is what these organizations are doing, is it legal?
It's a good question. So these guys have managed to to sort of wedge themselves into a little piece of the campaign finance system that is very lightly regulated and not very transparent. The system is basically set up to police people who give money to candidates, who raise money and then like use it to help politicians get elected. If you raise money and then don't help politicians get elected, that sort of gives you, you're not regulated by some other agencies. Instead, the IRS actually is the one that watches over them. And the rules that apply to them under the IRS are pretty loose. All the IRS says is you have to be operated primarily is the key word, for the purpose of influencing elections. And now, they argue that they fit that definition. A lot of campaign finance experts I talked to said it sounds like they don't. But the problem, the answer would come from the IRS, and even worse for us as people on the outside trying to figure out what's going on, the IRS keeps all these things secret. So they would not tell us what they did to these groups unless they happened to, charge them in a court of law.
It seems surprising that the law is so lax around nonprofits, given philanthropy in America and how people try to look into the groups that they give money to. Where are the gaps here?
Well, you're right that there's a gap. This sort of technique, the idea that you would set up something, raise donations, and then sort of not spend the donations on the things you said you'd use them for, That is a scheme that's been around a long time in charities and charitable nonprofits or regular non-political nonprofits. And because of that, states have stepped in. State attorneys general usually have stepped in. And if you do that in a charity, if you did the same thing that I'm talking about in a charity, you might have to answer to a state attorney general. And the, one of the things we've seen is that people who run these operations have migrated into politics, because in politics you can sort of use the First Amendment as a shield. A, first of all, if you do it as a national political group, you don't have to worry about state attorneys general. It's outside their jurisdiction. But also the regulators are really reluctant to step in and tell political groups what they can and can't do because it's, you know, protected by the First Amendment. So the last piece of this, the last way that this is sort of darkly genius is that the political campaign finance system was designed by politicians, and they had sort of a blind spot. Their blind spot was, well, we expect that anybody who raises money for politics is going to spend it on politics. Well, why would you do it if you weren't going to? But if you raise money for politics, like I said, and then don't, and then siphon it out of politics, they haven't really built a system to stop that. So this is like a loophole within a loophole that these guys are operating in.
So what you're saying, our campaign finance system isn't able to monitor and snuff out this kind of manipulation on, you know, people who get these solicitations.
Yeah, what I've heard is the campaign finance system, you know, a charitable system is built to protect a donor. A charitable system is built for the government to step in if a donor is getting tricked or if a donor is being lied to. The political system is not. There's not that protection in there for the donors. And that's what these guys seem to be sort of operating in.
Let's take a call now. Paul is joining us from Summit. Paul, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi. I think I've answered one of these calls from the police department or somebody raising money for police. And as an educator, I began to press them on their lack of support for us during 2011. I said, I support the police, blah, blah, blah. But my question to the gentleman is, I think it was a combination of talking to a machine and then a person too. It first sounded like a machine and then a person. I mean, is that happening as well too? Because then the person got very confused, or maybe the machine did. I wasn't quite sure who I was talking to.
Interesting. Paul, thank you. David?
That does happen. This what they call a soundboard technology, what you heard in the beginning of this of our segment, the recorded calls, They've tried to record snippets of dialogue to handle a lot of the common responses, but there's also a person doing it, and that person is there to respond. If you ask a question or your conversation goes beyond what the sort of snippets of dialogue are prepared to handle, that person can step in. So, yes, that doesn't happen often, but if you press these folks, you may get to talk to the human behind the machine.
David Farenthold, investigative reporter at the New York Times, looking into consultants using sophisticated robocalls to raise millions of dollars and the system behind it. Call now with a question, thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin-based robocalls raised tens of millions of dollars, claiming to support pro-police and pro-veteran political causes. Call in with questions, what you wonder, 800-642-1234. David Farenthold is an investigative reporter at the New York Times. Angela in Madison. Hi, Angela. What would you like to share?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is this. I signed up on the Do Not Call list, and yet these calls to which you're referring continue to come through. And I thought that was sort of the purpose of the Do Not Call list. So I'm wondering what light you can shed on why that's still happening.
Thank you, Angela. Go ahead, David.
This is a really frustrating element because you're right. The Do Not Call list does not actually stop these people. The political calls, like groups like this, are actually exempt from the Do Not Call list. Now, there's a couple of things you can do in the meantime. Well, first of all, I should say that in July, there will be some new rules coming in by the federal government that will limit these guys to how many times they can call you in a month. I think it's 3 times in a month. But that does not depend on the do not call list. But that's just a rule that will apply to them more generally. Two things you can think about. One is your cell phone. The landlines are they're free to call your landline, at least for now, as much as they want. If they call your cell phone, that's illegal. It's actually barred by law. You can complain about that to the Federal Communications Commission. And if you really get mad, you can sue them. And actually, the Federal Communication, there's a federal law from the 90s that gives you a private right to sue groups, robocallers who call your cell phone. You can sue them for up to $500 per call or $1,500 if you think it's negligent. And I've talked to people who've sued these guys and gotten like $10,000 out of them. So if you're really mad, you can sue. But for now, your best hope is to file a complaint if it's your mobile phone, and then to wait till July, and then you'll have more protections for your landline.
Angela, thank you for the call. David, we heard from Mike in Marshall, called in and wants to know if these consultants have had to pay taxes on the money they received.
That's a really good question. As far as I can tell, I can only see the taxes, their tax returns for these nonprofit groups. I can't see them for the private companies, but they should. And this is reported as income to companies, private companies these guys own. Just as an aside, one thing that I'm really interested in is knowing who owns the mailing list that these things create. So these guys are the donor list. As these nonprofits work, they're creating lists of thousands of people who've given them money. And that's a really valuable thing to other nonprofits, to political campaigns. And you can sell those things or rent them for, you know, what could be millions of dollars.
And this is our private data.
Right. This is your data that you've quote unquote given to them because you've given them, you know, you didn't realize it, but you gave it to them when you paid them, when you donated money. And so we can't see in the tax returns any evidence of these nonprofits selling their list. But I will be really interested to know if somehow one of these consultants got ownership of one of those lists, because that could be far more lucrative than the money we see in these nonprofit returns.
Give us some distinctions here. The robocaller is reporting financial dealings through the IRS rather than the Federal Election Commission. Is that significant?
It is. So the Federal Election Commission, people have probably heard of that. They're not perfect. They are, in some cases, sort of toothless, but they have a great website. They are very transparent. And so if you give money and if you report your spending to the FEC, it's really easy to search it and figure out who spent what. But they only kick in if you give more than $1,000 to any federal political candidate or help any political candidate give help more than $1,000 worth. And so that's the genius of this for these guys, is because they don't do anything really to help federal candidates. They don't cross that $1,000 threshold. They don't have to report to the FEC. And so they stay in this kind of backwater regulated only by the IRS. And so not only is the IRS a less aggressive regulator, the transparency is so much worse. And so instead of having their spending and all the details of who they spent, what they spent with who, put in an easily searchable database, which you get when you go to the IRS is like 15,000 pages of non-searchable PDF pages. Mm-hmm. It took us a huge amount of computer work just to turn that into something that we could search.
So is there a federal agency that you see, you know, making moves here or taking a lead on this to investigate and stop these types of shady donation and this marketplace from growing even bigger?
The main action that's taken place so far has been from the Department of Justice, and not in these guys' cases, but in general. The Department of Justice calls groups they call scam PACs groups that raise tons of money on political purposes and then don't spend it on politics, spend it on fundraising, spend it on insiders. And they've prosecuted, I think, about 9 cases worth of people like that. And usually the charge is not you violated this technical provision of campaign finance law, because as we said, campaign and finance law isn't really written to stop these guys, but they just charge them with wire fraud. You know, you lie to people over the phone. That's wire fraud. And so they've done that, but it seems like a drop in the bucket compared to the actual scale of this that's going on.
David Farenthold with us, investigative reporter at The New York Times. You can call in with questions at 800-642-1234. So, David, what about the themes here? Police, veterans, firefighters, names of these groups, the National Police Support Fund, American Veterans Honor Fund. What do you make of the rhetoric?
Well, these sort of appeals and those causes have been used, unfortunately, in scams in the world of nonprofit charities for years and years and years, because who doesn't want to help the police? Who doesn't want to help firefighters? You know, if you get a call saying firefighters are in trouble, they need your money, that's an appeal that really, you know, people are going to really buy into. And the advice that we get from lots of people is just don't donate over the phone. You know, if you get a call from a group that sounds legit, write down their name, you know, look up their website. You know, if they're really a good group, if you know, they won't mind. They'll be happy for you to go look on their website and learn more about them and then give them money. Don't give money to people who call over the phone. Just because what sounds legit, like something like the American Police Officers Alliance, you know, there's no law that says that those have to be police. In this case, they weren't. There were no police involved. You know, you can't just put trust in a group's name. So if you really think a group sounds great over the phone, write down their name, do some research, and give some other way. Don't do it over the phone.
How are conservative politicians responding to this type of fundraising by these groups?
This is what's surprising, which is that they're not. They're really not. The FEC, which has its own problem with these groups, there's been some small efforts to get Congress to pass more laws and restrict them even more, but Congress hasn't done anything, which surprises me, because if anybody's losing money out of this, other than the donors, it's the Republican politicians. These are people who probably would have given money to a Republican politician, or maybe thought they were giving money to a Republican politician. So that's $89 million. A big chunk of that could have ended up in Republican campaign chests. So I'm surprised that Republicans have not taken more action to do this, because they lose much more of this money than Democrats do.
I want to land on here how you did this work. You mentioned the 15,000 pages of financial reports not in a searchable order at all. What are the challenges in sifting through this much documentation?
Well, this was a case where it seemed that people were trying to obscure something through complexity. You know, they had to report something of what they were doing, and they tried to report it in a way that was maximally difficult to understand. And so they would report – they have to report what they spent money on to the IRS, but they would report it in a way where they would create just a giant pile of paper to get through. So just one of these groups, one of these five groups, for 1 6-month period would say, oh, here's our expenditures. It's a PDF that's 900 pages long, and we report transactions as small as a dollar. So we broke – you know, $3 million in spending out into $1 increments. And so to make sense of that without like a powerful computer behind you, you'd have to, I guess, write it all down by hand, add it up by hand. I would have been impossible, even for somebody, you know, whose job it is to figure it out, like me. So we used computers to scrape all that and turn those thousands, and I think it was 135,000 transactions into a spreadsheet. But even then, there's another layer of complexity, because these groups use shell companies. They don't say we're paying money to John Connors. They say we're paying money to Voter Mobilization LLC, which is a shell company owned by a company owned by John Connors. Mm. So even when we knew the names of their vendors, it took extra steps to figure out, well, who owns them, and tracing it through all these different corporate shell ownerships.
David, thank you for joining us and sharing this reporting.
Thank you.
David Farenthold is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. We have a link to the investigation called How to Raise $89 Million in Small Donations and Make It Disappear. It's at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.